explained their concerns for the situation.
Muslim families in the borough are particularly affected, especially due to the housing benefit cap, for example, which disproportionately affects families that have more than two children, which, you know, applies to a lot of Muslim families. And so there are families that are living in inappropriate accommodation and not accessing the benefits that they should be entitled to because of these unfair policies. All we're doing is seeing numbers rising. We're hearing firsthand from guests how worried they are, especially now that we're in April, we're in this new financial year, and the guests that are coming through the door are extremely worried about the energy bills that are going to hit them this month.
During Ramadan, Muslims who can afford it make a religious donation to help others less well-off, called zakat. With the economy wavering, more will be forced to rely on this generosity of strangers just to survive. Robert Carter, London.
Hundreds of South Korean farmers and fishers protested in the country's financial and political center, Yeouido, demanding the government reconsider its intention to enter into yet another free trade agreement. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, will follow in the footsteps of previous rounds of deals. The critics argue usher in cheap foreign goods and jeopardize domestic producers.
In the past, during the Uruguay round, the government made fun of the farmers once. And then, during the South Korea-US and South Korea-China FTAs, they deceived our farmers a second time. With the indoctrination of the CPTPP, we are about to be deceived a third time. Should we be deceived?
The 11-member CPTPP includes Vietnam, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Mexico. South Korea only a month ago joined a 15-member trade bloc led by China, as Seoul moves to open 90% of the country's agricultural market. Farmers and fishers demand consultation.
When the government tries to introduce this type of thing, it has to have some policies prepared, discussing with farmers to some extent. And there should be some hope for agriculture and rural areas. But I don't think it should be pushed unilaterally like this.
Proponents say South Korea's high-tech export-led model needs all the help it can get, with the CPTPP deal set to boost the country's GDP by one-third of 1%. South Korea's own Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy recognizes the negative impact such free trade deals have on those gathered here outside the country's National Assembly. With a corporate-friendly conservative president set to take office here in May, these farmers' concerns over their livelihoods will only grow. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Exactly 1 week before the first round of the French election, the embodiment of the past 5 years marched in Paris. Yellow vests who were crippled, blinded, and mutilated by police. On every Saturday from November 2018 until June 2019, a national bloodletting took place on a scope which was unprecedented in recent Western history. The numbers are as staggering as the lack of Western condemnation for the French government. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 imprisoned, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. Those who suffer the most say they don't want to be forgotten when voters go to the ballot box.
When you're mutilated by the police, there's naturally a lot of suffering and a lot of complications to our daily lives. But we keep our head held up high to show what Mr. Macron has done to his own people.
The huge phalanx of armed police, which still accompany the yellow vests every Saturday, kept their distance, while the mainstream media was not present at the protest almost at all.
It is the average citizens who supports us, because we do not even exist to this state or to the justice system. Where there is no police brutality and there are no victims, then how can we exist?
Over 75% of cases involving hurt protesters are immediately dropped without any court case or even an investigation. Punishment of police for mistreating yellow vest anti-government protesters has been almost non-existent.
By denying that there was any police brutality, the government legitimized it. How can we have confidence in a government which cripples its own citizens or in institutions which do not intervene to stop that? It is truly barbaric violence which chose to mutilate people simply because they believe in a better future.
The yellow vests are routinely credited with an approval rating of 75%, an unheard-of score in a country where perceptions of political corruption are commonplace. The state-sponsored police brutality, combined with the so-called anti-yellow vest laws, scared many into no longer attending public protests. President Emmanuel Macron is expected to win a close re-election, but the damage to France's international reputation cannot be estimated. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the sun sets, this divine voice calls for prayer. But during the fasting month of Ramadan, it also means that the fasting hours are over, and Muslims can eat iftar, or the breakfast. In Iran, the Ramadan crescent was sighted on the eve of Sunday, so Sunday was announced as the first day of the holy month.
Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking. It's a time to purify your soul and contemplate on your mission as a human being. It's an occasion to pray and get closer to God.
This holy month is a perfect time to be the best version of ourselves. We take part in charity works and try to be kind to people around us. It is a month of God, and it is so beautiful.
This is the third year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. But this year, COVID restrictions are eased, as the pandemic has partly subsided.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that Muslims mark Ramadan without serious worries over the coronavirus. With the majority being vaccinated, the holy month will once again see Muslims getting together for mass religious ceremonies and prayers.
Taking part in congregational prayers is one of the rituals Muslims do before iftar. Last year, such ceremonies were largely curtailed due to the pandemic. This was also the case for the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights of Ramadan, known as the Nights of Glory, when Muslims congregate at mosques to pray and make wishes.
This year, we will host worshippers for the Nights of Glory. During the past 2 years, praying ceremonies were either cancelled or held with social distancing and with a limited participation to curb the pandemic.
Last year and the year before, I caught the virus and couldn't fast the entire month of Ramadan. But thank God, this year everyone is vaccinated and we can observe the holy month together.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. Based on this calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. The holy month will end with a major festivity called Eid al-Fitr, or the festival of breaking the fast. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. For the past few weeks, we have been explaining Surah Qamar, which was revealed in Mecca and deals mainly with the punishment of disbelievers of the past generations as a warning to the pagans of Mecca and also to the disbelievers of all times with the refrain, "Is there anyone who will be admonished?" running throughout the surah. The miserable fate of the disbelievers on the Day of Judgment is contrasted to the everlasting bliss the believers will enjoy in Paradise. An interesting feature of this surah is that all 55 of its ayahs end with the letter R. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 41 and 42.
وَلَقَدْ جَاءَ آلَ فِرْعَوْنَ النُّذُرُ كَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا كُلِّهَا فَأَخَذْنَاهُمْ أَخْذَ عَزِيزٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ.
Certainly the warnings came to Pharaoh's clan, who denied all our signs. So we seized them with the seizing of one who is almighty, omnipotent. If you remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Qamar last Friday, we dwelt on the terrible fate of the homosexual people of Sodom, Gomorrah, and other cities, for whose guidance God Almighty had sent Prophet Lot. But except for a few, the majority indulged in the unnaturally abominable habit of sodomy, or gay, to use the modern Western term. We said a nation of disbelievers that is immersed in cardinal sins will eventually be struck by divine wrath after God has given ample respite for repentance and sealed his argumentation, since none can stand against the will of the Almighty Creator, which prevails over all and everything. We also said, the Noble Quran is not a book of history, but it gives an accurate narration of selective events of the past in order to wake up human conscience to help discover the truth. The ayahs that we recited to you now refer to the destruction brought upon himself and his arrogant followers by Egypt's tyrannical pharaoh, who claimed to be God and had enslaved the monotheist Israelites, despite the admonishment of Prophet Moses, peace upon him, to release them by showing astounding miracles. Ayah 42 pertains to the denial of manifest truth by Pharaoh and his arrogant clan, who considered divine signs as lies, magic, or coincidence. God Almighty is saying that he sees them by his might so that it may be known to all that the groundless claims of might and grandeur by tyrants are nothing against divine omnipotence and glory. Even small beings like locusts, frogs, and a kind of insect called gumal vanquished the sinful Egyptians, rendering them helpless and led to their destruction through drowning. These ayahs teach us that, number one, obedience to unjust rulers and tyrants means complicity in their crimes. Number two, miracles are meant to awaken people and seal the argumentation so that sinners may not have any excuse in the face of divine wrath. And number three, power, might, and glory belong to the all-merciful Creator before whom nothing can stand. Now let us listen to ayahs 43, 44, 45, and 46 of the same surah.
أَكُفَّارُكُمْ خَيْرٌ مِّنْ أُولَائِكُمْ أَمْ لَكُمْ بَرَاءَةٌ فِي الزُّبُرِ أَمْ يَقُولُونَ نَحْنُ جَمِيعٌ مُّنْتَصِرٌ سيهزم الجمع ويولون الدبر بل الساعة موعدهم والساعة أدهى وأمر.
Are you faithless better than those, or do you have some immunity in the scriptures? Do they say, we are a confederate league? The league will soon be rooted and turn its back to flee. Rather, the hour is their Christ, and the hour will be most calamitous and bitter. After recounting the terrible fate of some of the powerful nations of the past for their sins, these ayahs address the polytheist Arabs of Mecca and mean to ask them, are you disbelievers better than those of the past? Or your disobedience, animosity, and disbelief are less than theirs? Is there any difference between you and the peoples of Pharaoh, Thamud, Ad, and Sodom? Is there immunity for you against divine wrath in the heavenly revealed scriptures? Ayahs 44 and 45 refute the claim of the pagan Arabs that they were a great league of confederates who wreak vengeance upon enemies and vanquish them, by predicting that soon you will be defeated and flee from battlefields, as was the case in battles like Badr, when the seemingly mighty hordes of pagan Arabs were put to flight by a few hundred lightly armed Muslims. Ayah 46 means to say that more terrible than the defeat on the battlefields shall be the fate of the disbelievers on the day of resurrection, when more horrible and bitterer punishments await them. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, arrogance, vanity, and egotism lead to a person's destruction. Number two, whatever we possess, including wealth and power, is given by God, in whose infinite might we should trust, rather than being self-conceited. And number three, it is a divine promise to annihilate oppression and injustice. Now let us listen to ayahs 47, 48, 49, and 50 of Surah Qamar.
Inna al-mujrimina fi dhalalin wa su'ur yawma yus'habuna fin-nar 'ala wujuhihim dhuqu massa saqar inna kulla shay'in khalaqnahu biqadar وما أمرنا إلا واحدة كلمح بالبصر.
Indeed, the guilty are in error and madness. The day when they are dragged into the fire on their faces, it will be said to them, "Taste the touch of hell." Indeed, we have created everything in a measure, and our command is but a single word, like the twinkling of an eye. These ayahs depict the fate of the disbelievers and intransigent sinners who turn away from the path of virtue by choosing the path of vices and thus bring about their own destruction. On the day of judgment, such people will be dragged into the eternal inferno, and it shall be said unto them, "Taste the heat and hardship of hell, which you denied and belittled." Ayah 49 means to say that the torment inflicted upon the sinners is consistent with their evil deeds and not greater. Since God Almighty has created everything in its due measure. In other words, divine acts are well measured, wise, and fast. And as Ayah 50 says, God's commandment is but one, and it is done as fast as the twinkling of an eye. Whatever the Almighty Creator wills, He merely says, "Be," and it will come into being. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, we ought to be always conscious of and in constant awe of our beloved Creator, whose commandments should be obeyed and to whom we should be thankful for His infinite blessings. Number two, the fate of those who die in the state of disbelief and sins is terrible. And number three, God has created everything in proper measure on the basis of justice, hence reward and punishment are meted out with exact measure. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we present you ayahs 51, 52, 53, 54, and 55, which also mark the end of Surah Qamar.
وَلَقَدْ أَهْلَكْنَا أَشْيَاعَكُمْ فَهَلْ مِن مُدَّكِرٍ وَكُلُّ شَيْءٍ فَعَلُوهُ فِي الزُّبُرِ وَكُلُّ صَغِيرٍ وَكَبِيرٍ مُسْتَطَرٍ إِنَّ الْمُتَّقِينَ فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَنَهَرٍ فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِندَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ.
And certainly we have destroyed your likes, so is there anyone who will be admonished? And everything they have done is in the box, and everything big and small is committed to writing. Indeed, the God very will be amid gardens and streams, in the abode of truthfulness with an omnipotent king. Ayah 51 refers to the divine principle of the destruction of the evil nations, so as to serve as a warning to the coming generations, who ought to take admonishments in order to abstain from sins by following the path of virtue. The next two ayahs are a reference to the fundamental principle that the deeds committed by the past generations were not effaced following their death, but whatever was done by them, whether big or small, has been preserved in the records of their deeds. Likewise, the deeds of all people, including the present and the future generations, will be recorded and preserved for the day of reckoning. Everything is registered, and on the day of judgment, the system of reward and punishment will put into effect with full exactness. Ayahs 54 and 55, which mark conclusion of Surah Qamar, refer to the lofty position of the righteous in the eternal bliss of paradise. Firstly, mention is made of the material bounties like vast gardens and rivers in paradise. And secondly, mention is made of their great spiritual reward, namely presence at the threshold of proximity to the omnipotent Lord. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, the divine system of reward and punishment is absolutely just, and all people will be judged with fairness. Number two, although God knows everything and He is the judge on the day of judgment, our small and big deeds are registered exactly by angels and presented to us on the day of resurrection so that none can deny anything. And number three, the rewards of the inhabitants of paradise are not limited to physical and material pleasures, and they will enjoy such spiritual bounties as proximity to the prophets. As a matter of fact, spiritual pleasures are not describable or understandable for mankind. On this note, we come to the end of the explanation of Surah Qamar, and next Friday, God willing, we will start Surah Ar-Rahman. Goodbye.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome. I'm Kavit Tafwai. It was a first in Pakistan's history. For the first time, parliamentarians in its parliament chanted death to America. Now, this occurred while there was a no-confidence vote to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, which was rejected. Why is it that Pakistani lawmakers are saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process, including the Prime Minister? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this is the case and what Pakistan intends to do about its relation with the U.S. First, let's find out about all the developments that happened. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent who joins us from Islamabad. Well, there's quite a bit of ground for you to cover for us here. If you can highlight what actually occurred today.
Well, it was quite an unprecedented and a tumultuous day in the history of Pakistan. And the National Assembly of Pakistan was supposed to vote on a no-confidence motion moved by the opposition parties, but the government had other ideas. When the session started, the country's law minister stood up and stated that the speaker should not allow the vote of no confidence take place, since the government believes that this vote of no confidence was part of a foreign conspiracy to topple the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan, since according to the government, he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. And after listening to the law minister's remarks, the deputy speaker of the National Assembly, who happens to be the member of the ruling party, declared that this move by the opposition parties was not in line with the constitution, and hence he dismissed and did not allow opposition to vote on the vote of no confidence, although opposition had the numbers to unseat Prime Minister Imran Khan. And after that, Prime Minister Imran Khan appeared on a national television and congratulated the nation for what he said, defeating the conspiracy hatched by a foreign power. And then he advised President of Pakistan to dissolve the National Assembly and announce early election. And now the matter is before the Supreme Court of Pakistan, because opposition parties have challenged the ruling of the deputy speaker, because they think that the speaker had violated the constitutional provisions.
Thank you for that, Kamran Yusuf, correspondent there from Islamabad. We appreciate that. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Liaghat Ali Khan. He's the author, academic, and researcher who joins us from Topeka, Kansas. Also joining us is Shabir Rizvi, managing director of IFSA, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Liaghat Ali Khan, let me first start with you. In your assessment, what occurred in Parliament today was quite unprecedented, just like our correspondent there mentioned. Tell us about some of those developments, what you think it means, especially the fact that at this point we're looking at a Parliament that is dissolved, and then what we're looking at in terms of what the Prime Minister is promoting here.
Yes, thank you. Under the Constitution of Pakistan, when a no-confidence motion is in the National Assembly, the Prime Minister has no constitutional authority to dissolve the Assembly. And the Assembly must vote on the no-confidence motion. So today, on Sunday, this was the last day under the Constitution to vote on the no-confidence motion. But the Prime Minister, he has been arguing that the United States has given money and incentive and help to the opposition parties to overthrow his regime because he has been very close to China and Russia. And I think there is some evidence that the United States is not happy with the Prime Minister, and they won't mind if the Prime Minister is deseated. So to that extent, I think Mr. Khan has a good case. But then he goes further and argues that about 10 political parties, some are very religious parties, some have been anti-American political parties, they all are conspiring with the United States to unseat him, and some 20 members of his own party. So there are like 200 members out of 342 who would like to de-seat the prime minister. So I think it's very difficult for people, particularly in the legal community, to accept the assertion that 200 members of the National Assembly and 9 or 10 political parties of Pakistan, they are, they are traitors, the word he uses, and they are trying to overthrow his government because they are conspiring with the United States. So I think what he did is completely, blatantly unconstitutional. And I think the Supreme Court of Pakistan would say so.
So in your opinion, you don't think that what he is claiming is true, the fact that you have all these party members actually cooperating with the U.S.?
I think I don't know if what he's saying is true or untrue. But that is not the way to resolve the problem.
Sure.
I think if the opposition is actually conspiring with the United States to de-seat him, he needs to produce irrebuttable evidence before some court of law to show that that is the case. Mere allegation that 200 members of the National Assembly and mere allegation that 9 political parties are conspiring with the United States to overthrow him, I think that's a big claim.
Right.
And there is no due process to the evidence. There's no due process to the counterclaim of the opposition parties that they are against Prime Minister Khan because his government is incompetent.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Sure. Let's see what Shabir Rizvi thinks. Shabir Rizvi, we actually have something that's unprecedented, which I'd like to find out from you what you think about it, and that's the fact that you have the chance death to America that happened in Parliament, according to what we have received in reports. And also the fact that the National Assembly Deputy Speaker talking about how no foreign power should be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy. I'm wondering if he's obviously making a reference there to the U.S. And, of course, your thoughts on the chants that were made in Pakistan's Parliament.
Hello. Thank you very much, Kaveh. It's good to be back. And best wishes in Ramadan for all of us. Now, look, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I'm not an expert on the intricacies of the political parties in Pakistan. But I think what one has to really understand, whether Mr. Imran Khan is using the word conspiracy to strengthen his position or not, we have to look at a bit more in history. The first Prime Minister of Pakistan was assassinated by the CIA back in 1951. And continuously, the USA has interfered in Pakistan. And what one's got to understand is that both the two major parties, the Muslim League and also the Pakistan People's Party, they really have been quite corrupt in the last 30, 40 years. In Pakistan, the elite in Pakistan have really impoverished Pakistan, especially the two political dynasties, as I said. So they don't really have a very good record. And I really like to sort of put this in the mix for Pakistani elite who have investments in UK and USA. You can see that what's happened in the last 4 weeks, that some of the oligarchs' assets have been taken over in the UK and their bank accounts have been frozen. I hope the Sharifs and the Zardaris and Mr. Bilawal Bhutto and his sister and Maryam Sharif also should take that into account, that sooner or later their assets will be frozen in the UK. Uh-huh. So whether they want to be traitors to Pakistan, their livelihood and their assets will be taken over by Britain as soon as they are not in the good books of UK and USA.
Sure.
So, the opposition is playing a very tightrope and delicate game themselves.
Okay, so there you have the view in terms of at least the view from our guest there from London. Lighat Ali Khan about the opposition. But let's zoom in more on the accusations that has been leveled by Prime Minister Khan against the U.S. Now, based on what we have heard, one of the reasons that he believes the U.S. is behind what has happened in Parliament eventually with the no-confidence motion is because of his visit to Russia last month. Do you find that to be credible?
Yes.
Sorry,
I think the United States does not like that Pakistan, which has been an ally for the United States since its creation in 1947. So I think the United States is not happy, like it is not happy with many other countries that do not agree with the United States. And I think as a superpower, then the superpowers do that, whether it's Russia or China or the United States. They don't like small countries to have independent foreign policy. And I think Pakistan, Prime Minister Khan, he's saying that we want to have an independent foreign policy. Well, that's a very good idea. But the reality is that Pakistan is completely dependent on the West, whether it is the World Bank, whether it's the IMF, whether it is, the defense equipment, in so many ways.
Okay, so let me jump in there. Let me jump in there, Lighat Ali Khan. Ask Kamran Yousef, ask Shabir Rizvi whether he agrees with you on that. Shabir Rizvi, is Pakistan, as much as the Prime Minister wants a foreign policy independent from the U.S. and the West, can it do that? Or based on what our guest said, that's just really an idea that can't be done?
Look, Pakistan, like many other countries on this planet, have been impoverished by the elite and also by the superpowers. Now, whether Russia, China, or America act similarly, the experience is that since partition, and particularly when Pakistan took the side of USA under the pretext of fighting terrorism 20 years ago under General Musharraf, that clearly shows that Pakistan has come out a loser. So, Mr. Sharif, who is the main opposition leader at this moment, says that Pakistan is a poor country and poor countries have no rights. I mean, how dare that a particular leader in Pakistan says that poor countries have no rights? Therefore, all poor countries should forget about it. And Iran, next door to Pakistan, is a very good example that for the last 43 years, it had stood up against Iran, against USA.
Right.
And of course, sanctions have blighted the nation. It has created all kinds of problems. But at the end of the day, whether the West dislikes Iran or not, they respect Iran.
Sure.
While Pakistan, because of its own leaders, has no respect in London, Paris, or Washington. And that's what I think Imran Khan and some of the other leaders are trying to sort of get Pakistan to be a respected nation and not to be a vassal of Washington.
Exactly. Lighat Ali Khan, to break this open more, based again on news that we have, Pakistan's ambassador to Washington actually said that he has recorded a senior U.S. official.
Hello.
This is for Lighat Ali Khan. Pakistan's ambassador.
Hello, I can't hear you.
To Washington, who has recorded a senior U.S. official telling him they felt relations would be better if Khan left office. I mean, that goes beyond not having a country aligned with your foreign policy in the case of the U.S. to want Khan to leave office. Again, if this is true, which we believe that it is, do you think that is the way U.S. approaches it? The track record speaks as such.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. All superpowers and even middle powers, they want to influence other nations. Actually, let me say it to you. Not even the United States, the superpower, can pursue an independent foreign policy. This whole concept of independent foreign policy is passé. It's not valid. I think the nations are so mutually dependent that no country, no matter how strong, can pursue an independent foreign policy. So as a smart nation, not a foolish nation, as a smart nation, you have to see the enmeshment of the word. You have to understand that the word is no longer, you know, not united. It is united, sometimes in a pathological way, that we are dependent on each other. And there's hierarchy in the international community. So I think as a smart nation, you don't defy superpowers. You work with them, mm-hmm. and you make your case without destroying yourself. I think Saddam Hussein did that. Mr. Gaddafi did that. I think I would appreciate Iran is very smart. I think they fight in a beautiful way,
right?
In my view, that they resist, but they don't destroy their nation. And I think Pakistan should do the same.
Well, the problem is who makes a nation a superpower? The definition of that is where I think most of the problem is. So let me get to Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's really look at what has happened here when it comes to Imran Khan vis-a-vis the U.S. One of the problems that existed between the two, which was very big, was on the issue of Afghanistan. One of the tweets that Khan actually sent out was that to the U.S., said, "The U.S., we will be your friend, not your slave. We will help you withdraw from Afghanistan, but we will not launch military operation for you." That's just one of the stances of Imran Khan. So the U.S. obviously does not particularly care for Khan. Is that a correct conclusion to make on the relationship between Khan and the U.S.?
Well, look, it's becoming very clear that the direction that Imran Khan wants to take Pakistan, unlike the previous, the two political parties that I talked about, they have really sold their soul very cheaply for their children to be educated in UK and USA and to buy properties in this part of the world. In reality, they've had no love for their nation as such, other than sort of lining their pockets. Coming back to the issue of our friend talking about that no nation has independent policy, yes, I tend to agree with him to a degree. However, independence mean that trying to do things that are in the benefit of one's nation and people. Now, if that is the definition of being independent, fine. Otherwise, all nations have to work together. But what we have to really look at is the track record that the USA has in Pakistan and also globally, you know, whether it's sort of color revolutions in Ukraine that happened, as we know, or more recently in Kazakhstan and all over the place. And also assassinations are part of the baggage that USA carries if they do not try to remove a leader by a color revolution or by other conspiratorial methods, then they assassinate. IND is a good example. Lumumba in Congo is a good example. And I can go on and on and on for another hour listing where USA has assassinated other leaders. China, as far as I know, hasn't done that in the last few years. Far as I know, Russia, even in the previous Soviet Union, hasn't done that. So the really...
These two countries that you mentioned, I'd like to come to Liaquat Ali Khan and ask him. Liaquat Ali Khan, we're looking at China's relationship with Pakistan. Obviously a very close relationship. The Belt and Road Initiative has given Pakistan quite a bit of investment within the country, which has been ongoing for quite some time. And obviously Pakistan has long enjoyed diplomatic and business relationships with China. Again, multi-billion dollar development deals that they have had. The U.S. obviously does not like that either. So if you put Russia and then put this next to each other, and of course the way that Prime Minister Imran Khan has criticized the U.S. in terms of the way they operated in Afghanistan and saying that Pakistan could have done more, again, more reason for the U.S. to, according to Imran Khan, want him out?
I think if you want to criticize the United States or any other superpower, you should be an academic. But if you are the prime minister of a country, or if you are the president of a country, then your criticism is within the bounds of pragmatism. Then the interest of your country is superior to the morality of behavior. And I think this is where Mr. Khan, who himself has a very interesting background, He has been a playboy for many decades. And now, you know, he has a tasbih in his hand. And he is now, you know, peddling Islam. And I think he has every right to do so. But as the prime minister of a nuclear-powered country, whose economic power is very bad, he has to be pragmatic in his criticism, in his behavior, in his criticism of the United States particularly, mm-hmm. with which Pakistan has the highest international trade. And a lot of money comes from the United States in many forms. So simply from a pragmatic viewpoint, the prime minister cannot challenge the United States. And I think Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, when he detonated the nuclear bombs, President Clinton asked him not to do so. There was a lot of pressure on Nawaz not to detonate the nuclear bombs, but he did. And I think at the same time, he was very understanding and very sort of polite to Pakistan, to the United States. Sure.
Well, let's examine the role, if we can here, Shabir Rizvi, of the Pakistani army, and whether there is a stance there that is diverging from the prime minister. Because hours before Prime Minister Khan spoke earlier today, the head of the army, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, had said that Pakistan wanted to expand its ties with Washington. So it seems like they don't want to jeopardize that relationship. Do you think that has to deal with the billions of dollars, maybe in military aid that the U.S., at least we know, has given Pakistan? Is that what this is about? Or why do you think that Pakistani army is keen on expanding its relation with Washington and diverging from the stance that Imran Khan has?
Well, you quite rightly pointed out that the army has a lot of support in Washington and has continued to enjoy armament deals and trade that have benefited the military extremely. However, I think the whole global dynamics in the last 4 weeks has changed so significantly that USA is a declining power, without any doubt. The whole issue of the dollar perhaps not being the reserve currency in the next 5 years or even earlier, and the relationship that is developing between Russia, Iran, and China. And the reality is that Pakistan is in the East. It's not in the West. Yes, it does trade with the West. Yes, it wants to have relationship with the West. But really, the future of Pakistan lies with the East.
I'll have to jump in, give 30 seconds to Lighat Ali Khan. Lighat Ali Khan. I'm sorry, Shabir Rizvi. Lighat Ali Khan, 30 seconds. Where is Pakistan headed to now, given what has occurred? Are we looking at instability in that country? 30 seconds, please.
Yes, I think the Supreme Court would reverse what Imran Khan has done. They would restore the National Assembly, and Mr. Khan would be de-seated from prime ministership.
Okay, thank you. We'll leave it there. Lighat Ali Khan, author.